This is Medicaid Leadership Exchange, a podcast where Medicaid directors and other guests get frank about what it's like to steward the nation's largest health insurance program. Through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, 56 agencies administer a complex web of programs that provide access to essential health services. Listen in as we explore some of the challenges Medicaid leaders navigate and their top priorities to deliver services and build health.
Welcome to the Medicaid Leadership Exchange podcast. Today, we will focus on how stakeholders have helped to shape and inform the Medicaid program, including individuals, families, advocacy groups, and community leaders. To boil it down, we've chosen to focus on Medicaid waivers that serve children with diverse and often complex needs. In today's episode, you will hear directly about how the Herculean effort of one mom became a match strike for 40 years of Medicaid program evolution. Mark, would you like to introduce our listeners to today's guests?
Amy, I'd love to. So we are grateful to be joined today by two wonderful leaders in Medicaid, Barb Edwards and Joseph Ambernack. And Barb and Joseph, we're grateful for you being with us today. And I wonder if we could start by asking each of you to give us a quick background of your experience in Medicaid. And I'll ask Barb if you would start.
Sure. It's a privilege to join on this podcast. I was Medicaid director in Ohio for 8 years. From 1997 to 2005, it was a time of significant change in Medicaid, new with managed care, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and the long-term services and support waivers. I later served 5 years as director of the Disabled and Elderly Health Program Group at CMCS from 2010 to 2015. There was a lot of rulemaking and policy development going on in those days, and our group, part of what we did was to implement the long-term services and supports provisions of the Affordable Care Act. So it was exciting times. I also was a principal at Health Management Associates for 8 years. I'm now fully retired, and it took this topic to get me back in the saddle.
Barb, we're grateful to have you here today. Joseph, you're from Utah's Medicaid program. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. By way of formal education, didn't quite prepare me for this work necessarily. My background is in economics. And I have a bachelor's from the University of Calgary. I grew up primarily in Canada, but moved to the States in the late 2000s, where my long-term care journey and Medicaid started. The first handful of years doing long-term care eligibility from the financial perspective for individuals in nursing homes and on HCBS waivers, moving over to the policy side in 2012. The autism waiver, which was an early intervention program for children ages 2 through 7, is what drew me over to Utah Medicaid, and then I've been within our LTSS program for about 13 years now, doing various assignments such as quality assurance and waiver oversight, working on our critical incident and investigation procedures, adoption of the settings rule. And one of our big milestones lately was concluding a 5-year legal settlement with our state's protection and advocacy group on an Olmstead challenge regarding individuals in ICF. So have had the opportunity to work in a few different facets and have been privileged to be the long-term services and supports director for the last 4 years.
Wonderful. You both bring such fantastic experience to today's conversation. Barb, I'm going to go ahead and start with you. As I alluded to earlier, we've chosen the Katie Beckett waiver to illustrate the important role stakeholders can play in advancing Medicaid programs that seek to improve members' quality of life. Can you give us a synopsis of the program's origin?
Sure. I had the privilege to know Julie Beckett and hear her story firsthand after admiring her for years as being the mother of HCBS waivers. I met her when I was at CMCS. In 1981, Julie Beckett made what she thought was a simple request. She wanted to be able to care for her medically involved 3-year-old daughter, Katie, at home without losing access to Medicaid. Julie figured it would be better for Katie and for her family and actually save money for Medicaid. But Iowa's Medicaid program had to tell her that at that time the request was impossible. The only way Katie qualified for Medicaid was because she was in institutional care. Katie had been living in a hospital for over 2 years. She'd survived viral encephalitis as a baby, but it had left her ventilator dependent. And she had depleted the lifetime benefits on her parents' private health insurance policies, so had been enrolled into Medicaid. But if she went home, her parents' income and assets would be counted and Katie would lose all Medicaid services. So Julie was between that rock and a hard place. So Julie, who was a social studies teacher and taught civics, said, well, I think I'm going to go see if my congressman can help me. Her congressman was Tom Taube. Congressman Taube was impressed by Julie and touched by Katie's situation. He didn't quite know what to do, so he talked to the new vice president, George H.W. Bush, about Katie, who in turn told the new president, Ronald Reagan, about Katie. And it turns out that President Reagan, in his new administration, was looking for ways to demonstrate that government programs could be more cost-effective. He loved the idea that there was a smarter, less expensive way to care for this child. So he ordered the Secretary of Health and Human Services to find a way for Katie to go home with Medicaid support. So the secretary decided that maybe he could waive the eligibility rules. And Katie went home in time for Christmas that same year. It was such a feel-good story that the media got very involved. Julie was even asked to go on a national morning TV show to talk about what the president had done for her family. Julie told me that even while the show was on air, the other families began to call the White House saying that they needed this same option for their kids. Congress was interested, including Iowa Senators Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley. And in 1982, the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, TEFRA, was enacted, and it included authorization for the first HCBS waiver option in Medicaid. It was called the Katie Beckett waiver and was targeted for kids with complex medical needs. Sort of an incredible story with a very happy ending.
Yeah, truly an incredible story and truly an example, like the best example ever of how one parent can change the program and it impacts, you know, thousands of individuals throughout the country. I'm kind of curious, Barb, do you think this is kind of a typical advocacy story?
Absolutely not. I mean, anybody who's worked in these programs know that, first of all, the speed of this reform, the response for Katie was completely out of the norm, unfortunately, for all of us who are bureaucrats. But from the initial ask to the delivery of Katie's relief to formal policy change, totally incredible. And all of these reforms turned out to be transformational to the program in a way that I don't think even Julie could have imagined. Across populations, across the country, and frankly, having impact now on other programs like the Veterans Administration and even Medicare and other countries. So I don't think she had any of this in her head. but typical, of course not. You know, in Medicaid, a lot of reform starts at the state level and then moves nationally. But Julie didn't advocate at the state level. She went to a congressman who went to a president, and that's not the normal path. She wasn't a part of a movement. She wasn't a part of a state advocacy organization. She was just a mom, you know, who was the proverbial right person in the right place at the right time. She had a compelling story, a really good idea that was easy to understand, but it was the combination of right place, you know, right time. I think that the reason the waiver that Katie received became the tsunami that totally transformed Medicaid in terms of long-term care was because of all of the thousands of advocates and stakeholders who came after Julie, who continued to work over many, many, many decades to truly begin to transform the program. So I think that that's much more the norm. Julie planted the magic bean, but it took a lot of other people to move the to move it forward. The Americans with Disabilities Act was enacted in 1990. The Olmstead decision by the Supreme Court was 1999, where it became very clear from the court's decision that Medicaid, that states had serious obligations to provide options in the community for people that preferred to live there. And both of those milestones came from significant work on the part of advocates and stakeholders in the system. So, and at the state level, where waivers had to be adopted state by state by state, and often population by population by population, there was an enormous involvement on the part of stakeholders and advocates and caregivers and parents. So I think that Julie's experience was extraordinary. I think that the hard work of digging it out has continued now on for decades beyond that to get to where we are today. And, you know, most folks would tell you still an unfinished piece of work.
Something that stands out for me, Barb, is where you started the story, which was, I think your phrase was, it was a simple request. And I appreciate the distinction of some of the things that set this story apart from others, but I do appreciate how it starts with a human experience out there that oftentimes is grounded in a really basic need or challenge that folks face. Bishop, I want to recognize that Utah has had a lengthy history of engaging people around requests and engaging community and members in decision making. I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that practice and what it has meant.
Certainly. And like Barb's comments and the story of Julie and Katie Beckett, a lot of our younger populations, it is parents that end up being that catalyst for change within our system. There are probably no better advocates for a child than their parents. And we've seen that play out within our state as well. We've also had reforms like Utah's Medicaid expansion take place as a result of a ballot initiative. So we have a very strong population that is very willing to advocate for the gaps that exist within our system, either within Medicaid itself or looking for solutions that may offer other opportunities and enhance what we're doing. Things like the recognition where private insurance will have its limitations on where they are able to assist the family with the coverage of various items. The construction of Utah's medically complex children's waiver, for example, which is a 1915C waiver that we have, was simply the recognition that due to out-of-pocket expenses for middle-income or high-earning families, coverage limitations prevent or created situations where individuals were driven into low income or poverty income like situations as a result of paying for that care privately. Having that stakeholder voice inform both the state Medicaid program as well as lawmakers is crucial for us. We can prepare all of the data, prepare all of the information and charts, but being able to understand the real world implications that families face and what that means from a day-to-day living situation for them is not something we are able to replace. And we rely on that perspective from families, from our providers, to let us know when policy isn't quite meeting the needs of the folks that we work with.
I picture you sitting in the middle of people who were sharing their stories, a bunch of charts and graphs and data, and all the pressures of budgets and what's possible, not possible with policy. I wondered, what's it like to be the intersection of all of those things, and how do you carry that?
It is a little sobering at times to be that conduit, but I think we see it also as a partnership with the families that we work with, where, again, the data, the facts and figures are something we can readily help with. But hearing their story, hearing and seeing the effects that it has on their families, we routinely will solicit those comments when we are working on pilot programs or other efforts that we've initiated, so that the actual effects of our work can be heard. Again, very easy to maybe ignore a dollar sign on a piece of paper, but when you're seeing the story of that child, when you're seeing the pictures of them in their community and with their families, that's a side of the story we're unable to tell, and we rely on, again, our community to assist in that effort. It's incredibly gratifying work, and again, very very sobering to be in that position to assist change.
I was going to say, Joseph, I always found that community stakeholders and members and families in particular were so essential to telling our story to state policymakers and legislators. I'm just curious to know a little bit about how you've partnered with members and with families to, engage policymakers.
Certainly. Well, we don't lobby directly, of course. We do assist very frequently when families reach out to us. I think within the LTSS realm in particular, We're pretty accessible. The families figure out who we are very quickly and are not shy or hesitant about calling, which is something we absolutely respect. And it has forged some incredible relationships over the years. That does not go without its challenges, of course, but being able to work together to identify when shortcomings exist or kind of new efforts are necessary. It's incredible to be able to lean on again those relationships. Frequently and most commonly, our families are the ones who are shouldering the majority of the load. We may see kind of the need for those changes, but being able to partner to that extent where they are willing to essentially take up that banner and really push for necessary change. It's incredible to watch, frankly. We try in as many places as we can to hold those candid conversations where, again, that trust can be formed, that the relationship can be maintained. We have regular association meetings with various provider groups where we can have those conversations. They can ask about areas of needed work. Families, we have some great groups such as our Utah Parent Center. Who do an excellent job in being able to, again, provide resources to families as well as help coordinate efforts as it relates to advocacy and work with lawmakers. So we are definitely not alone, and those relationships are invaluable and something we don't take for granted.
Part of what stands out for me in what Joseph is describing is that that relationship, that partnership that he's discussing, is really different than the requirement to do communication and to inform members and community. You've had the experience of being at both the state and the federal level, and I'm wondering if you have comments about the distinction between, those times that we go out and tell people stuff from Medicaid. Compared to the kind of partnership that he's describing.
I think it's a you've raised a really good point. One of the biggest frustrations I've seen on the part of advocacy groups is that too often states confuse the idea of a communication strategy with an engagement strategy. And a communication strategy is important because folks in the community need to know what the state's policy intentions are and what's going on. But it is not the same thing as engagement because it's one way. If it's just a communication strategy, if you really have engagement going on, you are talking about two-way conversations. You're talking about the state listening, maybe more than they're speaking. You're talking about discussion. You're talking sometimes about debate and maybe joint problem solving. So I think there's a very big difference. And what I hear Joseph talking about is in relationship building. Is much more about a listening on the part of the state, problem solving together, really trying to learn as much as you're communicating about the state's decisions. I think communication strategies are also important. I've just seen enormous frustrations on the part of advocates and providers and others if states only have a communication strategy and don't have an engagement strategy.
Yeah, I think that distinction is really critical. Both are important, but you need to understand the difference, right? So, I have a question actually for both of you. I'm curious, what has your experience taught us about the best way to solicit and incorporate stakeholder input into discussions about Medicaid programming and advancement?
Perhaps building on that point is maybe trying to create forums where family and provider voices can be heard, perhaps even absent the Medicaid program. We use our Medicaid Advisory Committee to a significant extent in our budget making process, but more so trying to facilitate the conversation and, like Barb mentioned, maybe taking a back seat at times and making sure that those voices are amplified versus more so the one-way communication. We use that too as well as soliciting feedback when we're looking to change administrative rule or policy. But again, finding those mechanisms where again those voices can be heard, and less about the state perhaps directing the conversation and allowing a little bit more free flow between those entities. We're by no means perfect at it, but I think we do try to create those avenues and be able to listen in and assist in those takeaways.
I'd like to second that. When we were working in the late 90s to try to jumpstart Ohio's commitment to a true transformation of long-term services and supports. And we had a long way to go. When I became Medicaid director, I think 95% of the spending for long-term care was in institutions. So it was a big climb. One of the things we did early was to do a listening tour of the state. And we not only deliberately went all across the state, but we also invited multiple population long-term services and supports populations to participate together. So we invited people from the aging community and folks from the DD community and folks from groups and self-advocates around adults with disabilities. We also included behavioral health communities in these conversations. And we had people come together in forums with facilitated group activities where people could talk to each other as well as to the state folks that were there about issues that they were having in the system, where there were gaps, what the important issues were that they were trying to needed to be resolved and where Medicaid could help. So it was a very interesting process, both because we were trying to create an environment where we could listen, but also because we encouraged multiple population areas to talk not just to us, but to each other. It was a really terrific way of starting a process, I think. Later in that process, I mean, the governor's office took a huge lead in bringing all the state agencies together around a long-term care HCBS strategy. But we also then, I went out specifically and talked to the leaders of some of these advocacy organizations in the community and asked them if they would consider that there might be benefits if they got together collectively. Not just with us, but with each other, and began to talk about what some of the collective priorities were. There was a little bit of skepticism about that initially, I think, on the part of some of the groups, because, you know, they all had their own issues and they wanted to advance their own specific populations, you know, relevant issues. But I think when they began to talk to each other, they began to see that there was some power in collective thought and collective action on their part. They became very effective at working then with us, I think, in terms of bringing to us the issues we most needed to be paying attention to. And they became incredibly effective with the legislature as well, I think, because they could speak across the different populations. And when you bring the passion of parents and the political savvy and power of elders, and the passion of self-advocates together, it was pretty awesome as they began to feel their power, I think, collectively. So I think that was a way, at least at that point in time, that worked pretty effectively for us.
Yeah, I love kind of your historical perspective on this and that effort in the state of Ohio to really bring all parties together to talk about LTSS reform and bringing HCBS in as a critical resource for families. I have now a crystal ball question for both of you. How do we anticipate that the role of members, families, policymakers, health plans, et cetera, will evolve over the next decade?
You know, I don't anticipate that it's a lot different than it's been. It's one of those processes where it has to be renewed constantly. There's not a once and done with any of these activities. And as the fortune of Medicaid ebbs and flows, in terms of, you know, legislators have to be re-educated and governors need to be re-educated and state policy staff need to be constantly updated and kept current with regard to what the community issues, what the experiences of families really are. Families need to be constantly communicated with, self-advocates. So I think that it's an ongoing process. I think, in fact, as we are probably going to be facing some increased scrutiny on Medicaid and increased debate about the role of Medicaid and the value of Medicaid, engagement on the part of stakeholders will be as important in the next 5 to 10 years as it's ever been. And in fact, they may even be called on to help participate in some reimagining services and reimagining some parts of the system beyond what we've even accomplished to date.
Slightly a little less crystal ball, perhaps, but we do have some framework in places like the access rule with the discussion about the beneficiary advisory councils, the interested party work groups, maybe a little bit of my own unintended ignorance, but we think of issues like the direct care workforce shortage, and we assume or are very quick to under or believe that it may be a result of pay and compensation, when there are often many factors that go into some of those issues. And again, from maybe my own history, missing the opportunity to ask those questions directly to those individuals to find out what is interesting, challenging about the direct care service industry, as it doesn't always amount necessarily to pay. So hopefully, not sounding a little bit cliche, but again, bringing all of those collective experiences and perspectives together to problem solve it is key. We know that there will always be resource challenges. There will always be needs that go unfulfilled at times. But being able to understand where we can have the greatest impact and be able to emphasize those pieces, it is going to be something that, again, we rely on stakeholders to help point us in that right direction and be able to make sure that we can do the most with what we have available to us.
I think Joseph's right on that workforce is one of those areas where reimagining and really going to the source on that topic is going to be absolutely critical because I don't think our traditional solutions are going to get us where we need to go there.
So true, so true. Well, we need to wrap up for today. I want to thank both of you for joining us. I think this has been a fantastic conversation and has really shed light on the role of stakeholder engagement in informing state priorities and policy priorities really across the country. So, Mark, I'll just turn it over to you to offer any closing thoughts.
Barbara, I'm struck by your reminder that the connection between member experience and program policy decision making isn't always a given and doesn't always connect up through a vice president and a president. It feels like we are in times of big questions being asked, and I appreciate that both of you have raised the importance of listening, right? Of the simple process of listening, but I appreciate that that's not always easy. Sometimes it's hard to hear what we end up hearing. Just if you remind us that there are strategies in place, right? There are advisory boards, there are some of those opportunities. What I pick up from both of you, though, is the importance of what's the mindset with which we engage in those strategies, and what does it mean to be driven to want to hear when we have those conversations, so that we can really create that connection between member voice and the important big decisions that are going to be happening on a regular basis and have happened for decades that have really evolved Medicaid into what it is today. So what a pleasure to be able to share this conversation with you. Very grateful.
So, for our listeners, I want to thank you for joining us today and encourage you to tune in for other episodes of this season's Medicaid Leadership Exchange.
This podcast is a collaboration between the Center for Healthcare Strategies and the National Association of Medicaid Directors. It is made possible by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.